So, yes, born London, July 24th, 1725. And his father is a ship captain who would sail to different places, sailing merchant ships around mostly the Mediterranean. His mother, and his father does not seem to have really been a particularly religious person. His mother, however, was deeply religious, and from a very early age, she would instruct him in Christian truth. She taught him when he was 4 years old how to read, and he says that basically he was reading at an adult level by 4 years old, except for very difficult words. But she also, he says, filled his mind with many valuable pieces, chapters, and portions of scripture, catechisms, hymns, and poems. She was a member of a dissenting chapel, so not part of the Church of England, but one of the non-Church of England churches in the area, and she would take him to this church, and he would listen to the sermons. And later on, the pastor of this dissenting church, Dr. David Jennings, would later become a mentor in his life, but that would not happen until quite some time later. However, his mother was sick with a deadly disease, consumption, also known as tuberculosis, the same disease that David Brainerd had, and a disease, incidentally, which killed a quarter of all European adults in the 1800s. So at 6 years old, his mother dies. And Newton, only being 6 years old, he's considered too young to watch that happen, so he's not around. His mother was 27 years old when she dies, and he is six. After this, he's put in a boarding school, and he gets 2 years of formal education, from 8 years old to 10 years old. And this is the only formal education that John is going to get. Interestingly, he is at the top of his class in the subject of Latin at 8 to 10 years old. And so his foundation in Latin is going to be very helpful. He will learn all of his Latin foundation at this point, and we'll see that he will go on to use that quite a bit. But at 10 years old, his father pulls him out of school and says, "All right, you're grown up enough to go to sea," which was a very common practice at that time. Young boys, 10 years old, would start their career as sailors. So 10 years old, he goes on his first sea voyages, and he spends his teenage years assisting his father going on these different voyages. But as he grows into a teenager, he becomes a very rebellious young man. He engages in a lot of bad company, a lot of bad language, and yet the influence of his mother was not completely gone from his life. He still, even despite his bad habits, he's still also engaging in Bible reading and prayer. And so he would do the one and then kind of go back to the other and then go back to the one, go back to the other. You can kind of see him wrestling with these things. And two incidents happened during these teenage years that left a very big impression on him. One day when he's 12 years old, he's going horseback riding. And the horse bucks and throws him to the ground. As he's kind of stunned and getting up, he looks over and he sees that just inches from his head were these sharpened stakes. If he had gone just a little over, they would have got his head and he would have died. And obviously that's kind of scary for him. It leaves an impression on him. Later, a few years later, he is with a friend, or he's talking with a friend. They're like, "Let's go visit this warship that's in the dock. We could go and take a tour of this big warship that the British Navy has." So they schedule a visit, and Newton is running late. By the time that he finally gets to the dock, he sees the longboat that's taking his friend and the other tourists, and it's already pulled away, and he missed the boat. And yet, as he's standing there, regretting that he missed the boat, it capsizes. And the people in the boat, including his friend, drown. And he realizes, "I barely missed that boat." Again, it leaves a significant impression on him as he recognizes it's like God's present protecting his life. And these incidents lead him back to religion. And yet he describes it. He says, "It was a poor religion. It tended to make me gloomy, unsociable, and useless." And for about 2 years, he's pursuing God, but in this not a way that's making him cheerful and joyful, but just gloomy and sad all the time. Well, he's getting into his late teenage years, and his father is working to try to get him a good job. His father has a connection with a man named Joseph Manistee. Joseph Manistee is a businessman and a family friend, And he says, I've got a great job for young John. How about he sail to Jamaica? Because all of the West Indies, this part of the world, were filled with sugar plantations. And I could get a job for John managing a sugar plantation. He'll run the plantation, oversee the slaves, make sure that everything's going well. And after a few years of this, there's a lot of opportunity for him to really grow from that job. In fact, he could even at some point own his own plantation, which is a certain path to lots of riches and a very successful and easy life. So John has this great opportunity to travel to Jamaica, spend a few years as an apprentice managing one of these sugar plantations, and live a life of ease after that. And then something happens that will permanently change the course of his life. So he had, there's his father's family and his mother's family. And there was a bit of a tension going on between those two families. Even though his mother has now passed away, there's a lot of tension between those families, but they extend an invitation. They live quite a ways from London. But they say, they send a letter or somehow they communicate with John and say, we'd love to have you come visit sometime. And, okay, their names are the Catlets, the Catlett family. Newton isn't really particularly interested in that. He's got other things going on in his life. But his father has some business in the area close to the Catlett family. So he's got to go to do this business, take care of this thing that his father has assigned to him. It's December 12th, 1742. It's a pretty cold day. He goes, he takes care of that. It's late in the evening. He's like, I just want to get home. I'm not even going to stop by the Catlets. I don't know these people. I'm just going to be on my way. Well, as he's going, he realizes I'm only half a mile from their house. I may as well just stop by, just a quick visit. So he goes by their house. He knocks on the door, and this girl answers the door. Her name is Polly. He says, almost at the first sight of this girl, I felt an affection for her that never abated. This violent and commanding passion, a dark fire locked up in my breast, in degree it equaled all that the writers of romance have imagined. And so one look at this girl and he has instantly fallen in love with her. Now, there's a little bit of a problem. At this point, John is 17. This girl, Polly, or Mary as he would also call her, is 13 years old. So obviously, it's not like they can get married right now. In fact, of course, she's too young for any of this. So he doesn't say anything. He's completely quiet about it. He just happens to take that short visit that was supposed to last for a few minutes, and he lengthens it out to a few hours, turn into a few days, turn into a few weeks that he stays at the Catlett's house. Doesn't tell why, just finds excuses to just keep staying with them and just visit with them.
Now, what's she to them?
She's their daughter, so this is his cousin. Yes. So, yes, he has this reason, and no one else knows about it. His father doesn't know about it, the Catlets, Mary or Polly doesn't know about it. No one knows, but he knows why he's there extending his visit for weeks, and incidentally, missing the ship that will take him to Jamaica. Now, he says, I considered everything in a new light. I concluded it would be absolutely impossible to live at such a distance as Jamaica for a term of 4 or 5 years, and therefore determined that I would not go. And the method that he uses to not go is to just miss the ship. When he finally comes back to London, his father, understandably, is furious with him, especially because John doesn't explain why. He just missed the ship. It had to be very confusing for his dad as well as for Joseph Manistee, the man who has given him this opportunity. But his father's like, well, guess you're going back to sea. So he takes him on some more ship voyages. And John has really turned away from the things of the Lord at this point. He says, I did not as yet turn out profligate, but I was making large strides toward a total apostasy from God. So he really behaves very badly on these voyages. And you think about the company that he's keeping with these sailors on these ships. It's not good company for the most part. And John is learning all of their bad habits. But in his mind, this is a success because even though he's sailing around the Mediterranean, they're short voyages, and then he comes back to England. And so he'll get to visit the Catlets again. And so that's what happens. After this next sea voyage, he makes another journey to visit the Catlets. Again, not telling anyone why, not indicating even to her that he likes her, just trying to spend all the time that he can there. In the meantime, his father has arranged an interview for him to get a really good job on a merchant ship. And John extends his visit to the Catlets so long that he misses the interview.
His name is Mr. Boat.
And needless to say, his father is totally furious with him again. Just like, what do I do with this son? But there's one mistake that John makes during this time that will also have dramatic consequences for his life. See, at this time, it's right around the time of what we in America call the French and Indian War, and in Europe is called the Seven Years' War. It's right on that cusp of that. There's a lot of tension going on between England and France. These nations are not quite at war, but they're on the brink of war. And the Royal Navy had a very strange recruitment policy. You didn't walk into the local recruitment center to join the Royal Navy. You could, but the main way that they would gain sailors is they had what they called press gangs, meaning they would round up some of the sailors from the British Navy, and they would walk the streets, and any sailor that they could find when they were desperately short, they would basically kidnap you off the streets and make you a sailor on the Royal Navy. Because it was a very hard job. No one wanted to be a sailor on the British Navy. So you basically have to force people to do it. And there were laws that basically said, because this is for the defense of the country, we have to. It's basically like the draft, just a much more violent way of the draft. We kidnap you off the street to make you serve on the British Navy. Once you're on, it's very difficult to get off because there are ironclad laws about these ships. And it's very harsh, severe penalties for any infractions of the rules. John makes the mistake of taking strolls around the village that the Catlets live in while he's visiting them. And one day, he runs into a press gang. They recognize him as a sailor, and they basically kidnap him off the streets. They take him to the nearest warship, and they say, "You're going to be a sailor now on this ship." Also, war is about to break out, so we desperately need men. And he doesn't say much about his time on this ship. He just summarizes it this way. "I endured much hardship." If you've ever had an opportunity to visit any like recreations of these British warships, they were difficult places to live in and very hard work. You'd have very short hours of sleep. You'd be getting up for being on watch. You'd have, just a very challenging time. Now, his father, he's able to get a message to his father. And so his father hears about what has happened to him. And he rushes to the town, does everything that he can to try to get his son out of this position, using all of his connections, and he fails. He can't do anything. The British Navy won't give him up. After about 5 weeks, though, his father realizes, "I can't rescue John from the ship, so I'll do the next best thing. I'll try to get him a promotion so that his life is a little easier." And in this regard, because his father is a successful merchant sailor or captain, he's actually able to use those influences that he has to get his son promoted from just a common seaman to a midshipman. And it's a little higher level, just a little bit above the seaman, but it's an officer now. So he's got a better position. He's able to tell other people what to do instead of being on the receiving end of all those commands. And here again, his bad habits really start to catch up to him, because now that he's promoted, he uses this position very cruelly towards those who are underneath him. And needless to say, this is frustrating to his sailors. He was just one of them. He got a promotion, and now he's mistreating them. He says that he was haughty and unkind to the men who were underneath him. And he's also sullen and disrespectful to the officers that he's working with. So he's not getting any friends through any of this. Well, the ship goes, and it goes up into the North Sea. At this point, war has broken out, and it's guarding convoys of merchant ships against the French. When they come back, John, they dock in England, and John goes to the captain and he says, "Could I have one day off work?" And the captain says, "Sure, you get one day shore pass." So where does John go? That's right, he goes to the Catlets for 11 days. When he comes back, the captain is understandably furious with him. He has the opportunity to severely punish John Newton for this, but he doesn't. Incredibly, he allows him to remain as a midshipman. He doesn't really suffer many consequences, but the captain's not happy with him. So during this time, they go back to sea. They actually engage in a sea battle between the ship that he is on and a French ship, which they win the battle, so his life continues through this. And after winning this battle, the Admiralty in London says, "All right, for your next assignment as a warship, we are sending you to the East Indies." Now look at the map. Where are the East Indies? This is a 5-year assignment. And it's not like it's easy to run away once you're way over here. And so John Newton decides, "I'm not going."
I'm out.
So one day while they are preparing for this journey, he has an opportunity to take some sailors back to shore. They get in the longboat, they sail over. He's the midshipman, so he's in charge of the sailors, and he's responsible for making sure that no one deserts. You see where this is going. He gets about 24 hours away from the ship, and he runs into some Royal Marines who recognize him as a deserter. They take him back to the ship. They take him back to the captain. And needless to say, the captain is furious. This time, he does get demoted. He's not an officer anymore. If this officer wanted, he could have court-martialed John Newton, and the penalty for desertion is the death sentence. So John Newton could be court-martialed, but again, he's a very kind captain, and he doesn't court-martial him. But he does demote him to the level of a common sailor, and he orders him to be flogged, which was an event that would happen on the ships. They tie you up to the grating, they gather the whole ship's company there, and they flog you. That's part of the discipline on a Royal Navy warship. He's lashed to the gratings and flogged with a cat-o'-nine tails. But almost worse than the flogging is the fact that he gets demoted, because now all of those sailors that he's been mistreating are now the people he has to work with. And now it's time to go on the voyage to the East Indies. So the ship sails. And you can try to imagine what must have been going through John Newton's head at this point, as he's realizing, "I'm going to be 5 years on this ship working with these people. The captain is still furious at me, and he takes every opportunity to show me that he's furious at me. And I'm not going to get to see Polly for at least 5 years when I come back, if she's even single at that point." So he's really discouraged. He's very depressed. He says, "Nothing I either felt or feared distressed me so much as to see myself thus forcibly torn away from the object of my affections under a great improbability of ever seeing her again." He says, "My breast was filled with the most excruciating passions, eager desire, bitter rage, and black despair. Every hour exposed me to some new insult and hardship with no hope of relief or mitigation. No friend took my part, nor to listen to my complaint." He's very discouraged, and there's two thoughts that keep coming into his head. "I could assassinate the captain of this ship, or I could throw myself overboard." That's how low he is at. Well, 3 weeks into the journey, they come to the island of Madeira on the Canary Islands. And this is a great stopping point for the ship to get some more provisions before it continues They don't have the Suez Canal at this point, so they'll be going all the way under Africa and then coming over here. But they stop at Madeira, and while they're stopped at Madeira, that morning, John is in his hammock. That's how all the sailors sleep, in these hammocks that are strung up under the deck. And he's in his hammock, and they have roll call, so everyone's supposed to get up. Well, John is in such a terrible mental state, he just wants to sleep. He's being sullen again, angry with everyone. And so one of the officers comes by and sees him, and he tries to be kind to John. He's like, hey, it's time to get up. Come on. John won't budge out of his hammock. So finally, the officer takes his knife, cuts the hammock. Boom. John Newton crashes to the ground. He's furious, but he can't show it, because if he's insubordinate, he'll get more penalties. So he just gathers up his stuff, and as he goes up, he sees an interesting sight. There's a boat coming alongside the ship, and there's some hubbub going on. He's like, what's going on? And he listens. What he hears is that the Royal Navy, which is always looking for good sailors and always short of them, has decided to impress two sailors from a visiting English merchant ship. Same idea. They're just kidnapping two sailors off of this merchant ship to use for the British Navy. But the agreement is, we get two of your sailors, we give you two of our sailors. And one man has already been chosen. It's his opportunity. John runs to every officer that he knows. Please, 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 let me be the second one. I want to get on that merchant ship. Please trade me for one of these merchant sailors. And incredibly, the captain says yes. Now, at this point, why does the captain say yes? Probably he just wants to get him out of his hair.
But what's the difference between their sailors and what? Why trade if there's nothing?
They're probably just higher quality.
Oh.
Yeah, you think about John Newton is who you get to give up. You get someone else. So I don't know why the captain does it, but he agrees to the trade. Probably he's just sick of John Newton. Let's give him to that other ship, and we'll take a better sailor in his place. And so in the course of moments, his life has gone from he's angry, he's frustrated, he's planning on this 5-year trip, and now suddenly he's been exchanged with a merchant ship that's going to travel to Africa and then come back to England. And you won't have to go on the voyage to the East Indies. It's an incredible opportunity. Not only that, but once he gets on the ship, he finds that the captain is actually friends with his dad. So you'd think that this would be wonderful, everything would be great. But John Newton, his heart is still not in a good spot. Regarding that sea voyage with this merchant ship to Africa, he describes his behavior on that. He says, I made a song in which I ridiculed his ship, speaking of the captain, his ship, his designs, and his person, and soon taught it to the ship's company. So the captain, needless to say, isn't a big fan of John Newton at this point. He also says, I was exceedingly vile. I not only sinned with a high hand myself, but made it my study to tempt and seduce others upon every occasion. So not only is he going running into sin of every kind that he can find, he's also trying to get other people to do this with him. And the captain is not happy with him. But by the time that they get to Guinea, which is today, there's a country called with that name. But at that time in Africa, this entire coast, the west coast of Africa, is known as Guinea. So this is where they're going. The captain dies during this voyage, and the first mate becomes the captain. He's promoted. The first mate has even more anger at John Newton than the captain does. The first mate even goes so far as to say, if I come across a Royal Navy ship, guess what I'm going to do to you? I'm going to trade you back for someone else. And John, when he realizes that, he immediately goes, I've got to get off this ship. I can't wait around until we finish all of our time here and then sail back to England, because if we run into a Royal Navy warship, they're going to trade me, and then who knows what's going to happen? I might be headed back to the East Indies. So he realizes, I've got to get off this ship. And he happens to make a connection on board the ship. There's a man named Amos Clow. Amos Clow is a slave trader, and Clow owns a station on the coast of West Africa on Plantain Island. And so Clow, his whole business is that he trades with the Africans on the west coast of Africa. He buys slaves. He corrals them together in almost like these stockyards. And then he will sell the slaves to slave traders who will then sail them to the Americas to work on the sugar plantations in the West Indies. And so John strikes up this friendship with Amos Clow. And Clow says, why don't you come work with me? And it's like the perfect opportunity for John Newton. Now he can get off the ship, he can work with his friend Amos Clow, and make a lot of money, because this is a very profitable trade to buy and sell slaves. It's a very cruel job, but it's very lucrative. So John Newton agrees, and when they stop at Plantain Island, the first mate is more than happy to see him go. He says, we'll pay you when you get back to England, but good riddance, go work for Amos Clow. So he gets this job on Plantain Island. And once he gets there, he's working with Clow, but very quickly there's a very hostile relationship that develops between John Newton and Amos Clow has a mistress. She's an African princess. Her name is P.I. And P.I. takes an immediate and very strong disliking to John Newton. We don't really know why. We just know that she does not like him and he does not like her. But it's okay because Clow is right there and Clow is taking care of his friend. There's nothing bad going on at this point. But soon, Clow and Newton decide that they're going to go on a voyage into the interior to try to find more slaves. Well, they start into the interior of Africa, and John Newton gets really sick. Too sick to continue the voyage. Clow's like, well, I'm going to have to send you back to Plantain Island to recuperate while I continue the voyage. So he goes back to Plantain Island, and once he's there, the person responsible for taking care of him is P.I., and she treats him horribly. She's cruel to him. She withholds food and water for him. The only food that she'd give him is a few scraps off her dirty plate. She would toss them to him like a dog. And then she'd laugh at him. She'd taunt him. She would jeer him. So here's John Newton, desperately sick, fighting for survival. And the only food that he gets is these little scraps as she's ridiculing him and mocking him. He gets weaker and weaker every day. And his life is really bad at this point. He gets so hungry that he would wait until she's asleep and everyone's asleep. Then he would crawl out into the garden and he would dig up roots and eat these roots. He describes the effect of them. He says, it was the same as if I had taken a tartar emetic, which is another word for a medicine that makes you throw up. And he says, this is what these roots basically did to me. But I was so hungry that I would do this night after night, just to have something to fill my stomach. Sometimes P.I. would take limes and she'd throw them at him. Sometimes she'd even take stones and throw them at him. Her treatment was so terrible that eventually the slaves on the plantation start to take pity on John Newton. He's in such a bad position. They start to smuggle him little pieces of food to keep him alive. And so here he is, desperately sick, trying to recuperate, and he's at the level, he's basically a slave of this African princess. The slaves are taking compassion on him. He's about 20 years old at this time. And eventually, Amos Clow comes back from his voyage into the interior. John Newton comes, he's like, let me tell you what happened. And Clow doesn't believe it. No way. I don't believe it. But at least things get better because Clow's back. Newton's able to again continue his friendship with Clow. And they decide to go on another voyage into the interior now that he's recovered. So he recovers, and on the course of this voyage into the interior of Africa, they run across another slave trader who joins their party, and now it's the three of them working. But we don't know exactly why, but this other slave trader becomes very jealous of the relationship between John Newton and Amos Clow. He seems to want to break up the business relationship that's going on. So he starts accusing John Newton of various things to Amos Clow. He says, John Newton isn't honest. He's stealing your stuff. Now, John says later on, he's like, you could accuse me of pretty much anything and I was guilty of it. This was the one thing that I wasn't guilty of. But Clow believes him. And so, with no law, this is the lawless interior of Africa, Clow chains John Newton to the deck of the boat that they are traveling in. And so Clow and the other guy will now go into the interior every day, but they leave John on the riverbank chained to the ship or the boat that they're taking on this river. For 24 hours a day, he's just out in the elements, just surviving, chained to this boat. There's nothing to do when you're chained to a boat in the interior of Africa, except that John Newton, incredibly, had one book with him. And do you want to take a guess what kind of a book it was? It wasn't a Bible. It's a good idea. It would be far better if it was a Bible. Wasn't Pilgrim's Progress.
Some sort of, like, math or, like, geometry.
Euclid, a textbook of geometry. Excellent. So, for day after day, the only thing he has to do is study a textbook of geometry.
Oh, gosh, another die.
And he would spend hours a day chained to this ship with a stick, drawing in the dirt these geometric proofs, doing geometry class, teaching himself geometry, because there's nothing else to do when you're chained to a boat in the interior of Africa. Being fed starvation rations of rice. Anyways, eventually that voyage ends, and John Amos Clow comes back, takes John Newton with him back to Plantain Island, but no longer is this a partnership. Amos basically treats him as his personal slave and puts him to work in the crops, doing whatever he tells him to do. His life is the life of a slave now. Incredibly, you'd be like, how can this happen? Well, there's no law here. This is a place where people do whatever they want to do, and Clow wants John Newton to be his slave, so he treats him that way. One day, he's planting lime trees for Clow in the soil, and Clow walks by. He strolls by. His mistress, Princess P.I., is lounging on his shoulder, and they stop and they watch John work. And Clow says, he says, who knows that by the time these trees grow up and bear, you may go home to England, obtain the command of a ship, and return to reap the fruits of your labors. We see strange things sometimes happen. So he laughs at him in this way and then continues his stroll. It's a desperate situation for John, but one day another trader comes by the island. And this man is also a slave trader, but when he recognizes what's going on, he's horrified at the condition that John Newton is being kept in. And he offers Newton a job. And Clow agrees to this, so suddenly John Newton is freed from being a slave of Clow to being another slave trader with this other guy who's come. And they go to work, and he gets to live the life of a slave trader. Now, what Newton does with his freedom during this time is to run headlong into even more sin. He is soon sinking into even worse sins, living a very immoral life, and even dabbling in witchcraft. At this point, he's making a lot of money suddenly. And so he's a slave trader. He's in charge of the slaves. He can do anything he wants. It's basically an opportunity to play God, and you have a lot of money as you're doing this. He's 21 years old, and he's intoxicated by this life of evil. Obviously, it's a cruel and brutal trade that he's engaged in. And he likes it. He loves this life. In fact, he even decides, I don't think I'm going to go back to England. I'm going to keep living this life. It's so great. But then one day, in the morning, this ship comes in to the station where they're at, the slave trading station. The captain had seen some smoke and had just decided on a whim to stop in there and ask the people at the slave trading station, have they happened to hear about a man named John Newton, who apparently is in these areas? Well, this is where John Newton is. And so he's like, yes. And he meets with this captain. This captain says, well, your dad had heard about the situation that you were in, and he sent me to come and find you and take you back to England. That was actually more complicated than that. It was Joseph Manisty, you remember him, had an expedition planned. A merchant ship was coming down to Africa to do trading. And when John Newton's father hears that this ship is going, he's like, by the way, as a second part of the mission, can you try to find my son and bring him back? So this man had been stopping at all the different places along the coast of Africa without any success. And in fact, he'd given up his attempt to find John Newton. It was only on a whim he had seen the smoke rise that morning and thought, I'll just stop by this one more place and see if I can happen to find him. So he does. And John Newton has the opportunity to get on the ship and go back to England. And you know what he says? No, he doesn't want to go. But then the captain says, oh, and there's one other piece of information. You actually just inherited some property. It's worth about, the income that you'll make from that property is worth about, in modern day, $2 million a year. So if you come back, I'll let you stay in my cabin as a first class passenger to come back to England. And this is enough to finally turn it around for him. He says, okay, I think I'll do that. Within 60 minutes, so yeah, all of this happens within 60 minutes from the time that the ship pulls in to the time that he's decided to leave. So you see, his life is constantly just dramatic changes. He gets on the ship, and they're going to go back to England, but not yet. First, they're going to continue down the coast of Africa, and they're going to go all the way down to Cape Lopez, about 1,000 miles beyond. They're not a slave trading ship. This is just trading in different woods and spices and things like that along the coast of Africa. So he gets to be a first-class passenger on this ship as it sails down this ways. And they get to Cape Lopez. They turn around. They're going to cross the Atlantic, not to go to America, but just to catch better currents and winds. And they get over here. During this time, John Newton describes his life. He says, my life when awake was a course of most horrid impiety and profaneness. I know not that I have ever met so daring a blasphemer. Not content with horrid oaths and imprecations, I daily invented new ones, so that I was often seriously reproved by the captain. And this ship, it stops here at this port of Annobon, and then it continues across, like I said, nearly to the coast of Brazil, then up along the coast of America, and it comes out here. Now, he's bored. This is a long journey. It's like a year from the time that he gets on here until they're going to get back to England. So he's very bored, and on this ship, there are some other books. So he picks up a book called The Imitation of Christ. It's written by Thomas A. Kempis in the 1400s. Thomas A. Kempis was a Roman Catholic author, but Thomas A. Kempis was very devotional, and he wrote in protest of the current Roman Catholic system and how scholastic it had become. This is a book that not only many Catholics, but even many Protestants have appreciated, though we don't agree with all the theology, there's a lot of good in this book. And because he has nothing else to do, John Newton reads this book. He says he reads it very haphazardly, the way you'd read a romance novel, as he says it. But as he's reading it and thinking about it, he finds, I don't really like this. It's making me think thoughts I don't want to believe. So he finally decides, after perusing it for a number of days, I'm done reading The Imitation of Christ. Not going to pick that book up again. And he puts it down that evening. It's like, done with that one, go to bed. He lays down and goes to bed. And the next thing that he knows as he's waking up is a terrific crash of the ship. The ship lurches, and then as a massive wave slams into this ship. Moments later, water pours down the hatches and soaks John Newton. And then moments after that, there's a cry from the deck. The ship is going down. So he springs to his feet, and he's about to go up the stairs onto the deck of the ship. And the captain says, stop, grab the knife that's down there, and then come up. So he turns around, he grabs the knife. And while he turns to grab the knife, another sailor sprints up the stairs in front of him, just in time to be washed overboard and drowned by another wave. He continues up, and the ship has been massively damaged by this wave that has basically crushed the entire front. Water is pouring into the ship. The captain puts every man on the pumps, and they pump, and they pump, and they pump for hours and hours. But as fast as they pump, faster the water comes in, and they're going down. Finally, John Newton is so exhausted by his pumping that the captain takes him off of pumping duty and puts him at the helm to steer the ship. And he says that in order to keep himself from being swept overboard in this dramatic storm, he ties himself to the ship with a rope, and then for hours and hours guides the ship through the storm as everyone else is pumping. Now, finally, John Newton has a chance to think. and he thinks in a way that he's never thought before. The ship is on the verge of sinking, and Newton felt that the end was near, as all the sailors did. At one point, he says, as they're trying different things to keep it afloat, he says, "If this will not do, the Lord have mercy on us." And then as he says the words, it's stunning. He realizes this is the first time in years that he's actually desired mercy. He'd never even been thinking about the mercy of God. But then he's there steering the ship, and he has hours to think as everyone else is trying to keep it afloat. By the evening, they've stabilized the situation enough that the ship is limping along. It doesn't look like it's going to sink. But they're desperately short of food. Most of it has been washed out. They're still at least 10 days from shore, but they've only got 7 days worth of food. And that's if everything goes well. If the wind changes, the currents change, they're going to just be drifted away. And so for about 2 weeks, miserably cold, soaked, short on food, the ship limps along. After 2 weeks, it finally sees the sight of Ireland, and they're saved. When they finally get to shore, they open up the water casket, and they realize there was none left. The ones that they thought were filled with water were completely empty. If they had not gotten to Ireland then, they would have died of thirst. Well, it dramatically changes John Newton, and that becomes a turning point in his life. He says, "My leisure time from this point on was chiefly employed in reading and meditating on the scriptures and praying to the Lord for mercy and instruction. About this time, I began to know that there is a God who hears and answers prayer." So getting to England, he gets there and gets some pieces of news. First of all, the $2 million inheritance was completely fabricated by the captain just to get him on the ship. There is no inheritance waiting for him.
You're not having too much fun with this story at all.
But on the other hand, the families have talked, and they said, "John and Polly can get married." So this is good news for him, and he sets out to see her again. He gets to her, and when it's time to ask the question, he's too shy and he can't do it. So he doesn't, but he writes her a letter later and proposes that way, and she says yes.
What a win.
Then, incredibly, the family friend Joseph Manistee offers him more opportunities. Apparently, he had been highly recommended. So the captain had been furious with him. And after the storm attack, everyone's spirits were so low that the captain, who'd been hearing John Newton's whole time, all his curses and blasphemy and everything, he had even at one point, probably not seriously, had said, "Maybe God would rescue this ship if we tossed John Newton overboard, just like Jonah." But apparently he had behaved himself so well during the storm that his captain does give him a recommendation. And so Joseph Manistee gives him more opportunity. He puts him as the first mate of a slave ship. And so, about to be married with this conversion experience, he goes off as the first mate on a slave ship. Now, we got to move fast because we're running out of time. But they go, they sail back to Guinea, and it's not good. What happens? He says, "I declined fast. By the time I arrived at Guinea, I seemed to have forgotten all the Lord's mercies. I was almost as bad as before. The enemy prepared a train of temptations, and I became his easy prey." But when they get to Africa, he's one of the officers on the ship. He's the first mate on the ship. And so he gets in the longboat to go from the ship to the shore to get some supplies, and as he's getting into the longboat, the captain comes out and he's like, "John Newton, come back on board." He's like, "Okay." He comes back on board, and the longboat goes. It doesn't come back. It sinks, and the guy who took his place drowns. And he later goes to the captain. He's like, "Why did you have me come back?" He's like, "I don't know. It just like came into my mind that I shouldn't have you go on that longboat, so I just called you back." Well, this is the thing that John Newton needs to remind him again of the Lord's mercy. And now it becomes more lasting, the change that happens. He returns to his religious thoughts. And on the journey to America, it's pretty easy during the journey. You've got these slaves, you've got to keep the slaves from revolting. But other than that, it's pretty easy. So during this time, he turns back to translating ancient Latin authors. That's what he does during his free time on the ship, and meditating on scripture. Doesn't seem to have picked up the geometry that I know of after that. But on the journey back to England after selling their slaves, he describes it this way: I had for the most part peace of conscience, and my strongest desires were for the things of God. On February 11th, 1750, John Newton married Polly Catlett, and he loved married life so much. He did not want to leave her to go on a sea voyage. He tried everything he could to come up with a way to not have to go back. In fact, at this point, he got into purchasing lottery tickets in the random hope that maybe he would win big and not have to go back to sea so that he could spend time with his new bride. He even promised to give God some of the money if he won. But he doesn't win. And Joseph Manistee, because he needs a job, he has to go back to Joseph Manistee, who offers him the command of a slave trip. So now, as the captain of the Duke of Argyle, he sails back to Africa. And for the most part, while you're sailing, there's not much to do. So he spends his time translating Latin, reading the Bible, praying, and on Sundays gathering his sailors together for worship. Once he gets to Africa, there's a lot to do. Slaves to buy. He takes a short visit to Plantain Island just to say hi to P.I. and eat some limes off of those trees. And when he gets to America, he sells his slaves, and he has the opportunity to meet a lot of the other slave traders and the captains of their ships, and they all find him very odd. Like, we're all in this brutal business, and here's this guy who's reading his Bible and praying while he's selling slaves, and we're not living that way at all. It's a very interesting thing to think about John Newton, sailing, reading his Bible with hundreds of African slaves beneath him, writing love letters to his wife, and steering the ship at night by the stars. And yet that's what his life was like. Newton would later write of this time, "I never knew sweeter or more frequent hours of divine commission than in my last two voyages to Guinea, when I was almost secluded from society on shipboard, or when on shore among the natives reflecting on the singular goodness of the Lord to me." So three times he sails as captain of a slave ship to the coast of Africa. After the third voyage, when he's back in England, he suddenly has a medical condition, and we don't know exactly what happens to him. It was probably an epileptic seizure, but whatever it is, it ends his slave trading career. And they say, you're probably not fit medically to continue to sail. So he's out of a job again. But he gets a pretty neat opportunity to become the head of the port of Liverpool, basically, where he's got to inspect the ships, he's got to take in the tariffs and the customs that these ships would have to pay when they came into the port. So it's a very cush job. He's got hours and hours of time to himself, just going, visiting these things, and making a lot of money. This is a very nice government job that he has. As far as his time at the time, John Newton had no problem with the slave trade. Everyone accepted it. This was not something that was considered controversial, to trade in slaves. Looking back, he says about it, he says, "During the time I was engaged in the slave trade, I never had the last scruple as to its lawfulness. I was, upon the whole, satisfied with it. However, I considered myself as a sort of jailer, and I was sometimes shocked with an employment that was perpetually conversant with chains, bolts, and shackles. In this view, I had often petitioned in my prayers that the Lord in his own time would be pleased to fix me in a more humane calling and place me where I might be freed from those long separations from home that very often were hard to bear." Now, so you see, he basically is like, I'm a jailer. That's my job. I'm just keeping these people going until we get to the place where I can sell them. I'm going to rush through the rest of his life. There's not as many big turning points like that, but it's an incredibly fruitful time that he has. He meets George Whitefield during this time. He loves George Whitefield. He becomes associated with the Methodists. During this time, because he's got such a great job with so much free time, he pours that into Bible study. 3 hours a day he would translate from the Greek and Hebrew. And I did bring a Greek New Testament if anyone wants to see what Newton would have been going through. You can look at that afterwards. Eventually, he gets opportunities to preach. Starts out as a disaster. He wants to preach like George Whitefield, so he doesn't bring any notes into the pulpit. 10 minutes into his sermon, he runs out of anything to say. And he just stands there, and they look at him, and he looks at them, and then he walks off. But it gets better. And by the age of 33, he's seriously beginning to consider whether he has been called to ministry. So he engages in soul searching and 15,000 words of journaling before he finally comes to the view that, yes, the Lord, I believe, has called me to a ministry. For the next 6 years, he tries to find a pastorate. But because he's considered a Methodist, one of those enthusiasts, one of George Whitefield's followers, the Church of England doesn't want him. And for 6 years, they turn him down again and again and again, until finally he gets an opportunity where a bishop will agree to ordain him. And so he becomes the pastor of the Church of England congregation in Olney. During this time, a friend of his hears about the story of his life and encourages him to write out what has happened, his conversion experience, which he does in the name of the book, An Authentic Narrative. And this authentic narrative becomes the first thing that starts to get John Newton famous as people read this incredible story. He's ordained in the Anglican Church, placed in Olney, and he would preach twice on Sundays and give a spiritual lecture as well, so basically three times. He had a lot of different ministry things that he was doing, but he would also pray a great deal, twice a day, morning and evening, 1 to 2 hours every time. So his ministry is soaked in prayer. And he would also, every year, set aside the day that terrific storm had happened in the North Atlantic. Every day, every year, that day was set aside for special thanksgiving and prayer as he remembered the Lord's mercy. He would later say, I wasn't really a Christian at that point. I had so much that I didn't know, but that was the point where the Lord started to change me. He meets a man named William Cooper, which we'll get to him a different day, and they form a close friendship, and together they write the book, Olney Hymns. He writes the hymn Amazing Grace, which is not particularly popular in his life, but goes on to be the most popular hymn probably ever written in English. One of the hymns that I love is his hymn called Looking at the Cross, which I didn't really know about it until I started to read John Newton. But I want to read it to you because it shows how Newton was constantly fixing his eyes on Christ. This is from his book, Holy Hymns. In evil, long I took delight, unawed by shame or fear, till a new object struck my sight and stopped my wild career. I saw one hanging on a tree, in agonies and blood, who fixed his languid eyes on me as near his cross I stood. Sure, never till my latest breath can I forget that look. It seemed to charge me with his death, though not a word he spoke. My conscience felt and owned the guilt and plunged me in despair. I saw my sins his blood had spilt and helped to nail him there. Alas, I knew not what I did, but now my tears are vain. Where shall my trembling soul be hid? For I, the Lord, have slain. A second look he gave, which said, I freely all forgive. This blood is for thy ransom paid. I die that thou mayest live. Thus, while his death my sin displays in all its blackest hue, such is the mystery of grace. It seals my pardon too. With pleasing grief and mournful joy, my spirit now is filled, that I should such a life destroy, yet live by him I killed. And I think that poem does a wonderful job of showing how Newton's ministry becomes fixated on looking to Christ. He also would write letters, and he wrote a tremendous amount of letters. I want to give you a couple excerpts from some of his letters that I think are beautiful and really showcase the theology of John Newton as he turns his gaze to Christ again and again. He says, "Wonderful are the effects when a crucified, glorious Savior is presented by the power of the Spirit in the light of the Word to the eye of faith. This sight destroys the love of sin, heals the wounds of guilt, softens the hard heart, and fills the soul with peace, life, and joy, and makes obedience practical, desirable, and pleasant. If we could see this more, we should look less at other things." Now, I've got several other quotes that I love, but we don't have time to get to them, so I can't share those with you. But in 1779, December, he moves to London to become priest at St. Mary Woolnoth, which is another Anglican parish. And this is a time he's now getting into his 40s, 50s during this time. He continues his ministry, very fruitful ministry. He never has any children of his own, but he does adopt two children. One of them grows to adulthood. The other dies at 14 of consumption, tuberculosis. He forms a friendship with William Wilberforce, we will also be looking at, and becomes essentially the mentor to William Wilberforce and says to him, continue in politics and use your influence to try to combat the slave trade. In a book that he writes, or a pamphlet called Thoughts Upon the African Slave Trade, he says this, I hope it will always be a subject of humiliating reflection to me that I was once an active instrument in a business at which my heart now shudders. And he referred to the trade as a commerce so iniquitous, so cruel, so oppressive, so destructive as the African slave trade. In fact, he even goes before the Privy Council to give evidence as a former captain of what the slave trade was like. In 1790, after 40 years of marriage, Pauli died of breast cancer. Newton, during that afterwards, as he would journal about it, he would describe her death. There were a few things that he would say about that. He described her as a loan from God. He said that she was the hinge on which his whole life had turned. And he described her death as a wound that needed to be healed. But even in his 70s, he was continuing to preach as much as he could. He would go on for about 3 months in the late summer. Every year, he would go on voyages around London in a carriage and just stop at all the churches that he could to preach twice a day in his 70s. As he continued to grow older, his memory started to give way, and his sight as well. So eventually, he was getting to the point where his preaching, he would lose his place in his notes, and he couldn't remember what he was talking about. It became kind of embarrassing, and some of his friends did kind of where we have to go to parents and say, like, maybe it's time to turn in your keys. They had to go to him and be like, maybe it's time for you to not preach anymore. And so a friend brings this up to him, and this is what Newton says. I cannot stop. What? Shall the old African blasphemer stop while he can speak? But by the end, his memory was almost gone. He was mostly clueless of who people were, what was going on, but every once in a while, he'd have little glimpses of memory. Once a friend came to visit him, and he didn't really get anything from that time, except at one point, Newton said, my memory is nearly gone, but I remember two things. That I am a great sinner, and that Christ is a great Savior. He passed away on December 21st, 1807, and he was buried under an epitaph which he himself wrote before his death. John Newton, once an infidel and libertine, a servant of slaves in Africa, was by the rich mercy of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, preserved, restored, pardoned, and appointed to preach the faith he had long labored to destroy. Let's pray. We are really amazed, Lord, by the sovereign grace that you show. You showed it in John Newton's life, and you've shown it in our lives. Probably most of us won't have a story as dramatic as his, but oh, that we would be ones who would recognize grace in our own lives, who would recognize that you have been merciful to us and kind to us in a way that we cannot fathom. Thank you for this reminder. And we pray for your blessing on the rest of today and the preaching of your word. Amen.